Well, first of all, thank you very much to the Commission for the invitation to appear and to supplement our written submission with oral evidence. And also, on behalf of the Centre, can I say congratulations to the Commission on what I thought was an excellent discussion paper, which canvassed many of the issues and which I guess our submission in large part reiterates rather than adds to, because I think it was quite a comprehensive discussion paper. As you would be aware, the Human Rights Law Resource Centre aims to bring to bear the influence of international human rights norms and standards on domestic law and policy, and in particular to promote a harmonisation of domestic law and policy with international human rights standards. So our submission is focused very much on identifying the relevant standards and norms within the international human rights framework against which relevant domestic law and policy and practice might be measured, and I guess we've only in general terms looked at some of the areas where domestic law may engage or conflict with that international framework, and made some recommendations in relatively general terms. But our broad aim is to identify the framework for analysis and measurement, if you like. As you will have seen from the submission, which is not intended to be exhaustive, we've identified, three primary areas of concern for analysis, and very broadly they are the area of the right to equality and the right to freedom from discrimination, the right to health and the highest attainable standard of health, and rights of children, and I'll speak about each of them briefly and what we identify as their rights to same-sex relationships and financial and work-related entitlements and benefits. Looking first at, the most foundational right, which is the right to equality and the right to freedom from discrimination, as you will have seen from our submission, it's a right which is common to both the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, both of which in basically common articles prohibit discrimination on a range of enumerated grounds, which are intended to be non-exhaustive, in the realisation and the protection of the various rights contained within those covenants. Among the grounds that are enumerated are sex, which has been defined by or identified by the UN Human Rights Committee and also the Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights as including sexual orientation or sexual activity. And the covenants also recognise or prohibit discrimination in the realisation of rights on the basis of another status. And the jurisprudence suggests that other status is status as a member of an identifiable social group. So it's pretty clear from the instruments themselves and from the jurisprudence, which is developed from those instruments, that discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or sexual activity is unlawful, particularly in the areas of life covered by the covenant, by the covenants. The broad prohibition on discrimination in the areas of the realisation of civil, political, economic, social and cultural rights in each of the covenants is supplemented by a very strong provision within the ICCPR, Article 26 of which you'd be well aware, which extends the right to equality and to freedom from discrimination beyond merely the realisation of the rights contained in the covenants to protection from, in effect, any form of less favourable or unfair or unjust treatment in any area of public or private life regulated by public authorities or where public authorities have the capacity to intervene. I just wanted to say a few things briefly about the obligations of federal and state governments in particular in relation to the right to non-discrimination. As you would know, the federal government has a range of obligations under these treaties, namely obligations to respect human rights, so to themselves abstain from the violation of human rights, so in this case to themselves abstain from any form of discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or being a member of a same-sex couple. But moreover, they have an obligation to protect people from human rights violations, or in this case discrimination, which would require the enactment of comprehensive anti-discrimination legislation, which has been in part done, but also ensuring that their own legislation, whether in the area of social security or veterans allowances or superannuation, was non-discriminatory. And the third, and I think often overlooked aspect of their implementation obligations, is that they are under an obligation to take particular special measures where there are groups that may be vulnerable to discrimination or to human rights violations. So they're required to proactively take measures in an area such as same-sex relationships, where it's almost trite to say that discrimination is rife. I also just want to comment very briefly on the obligations of state governments, because it's often said that human rights are ratified by federal governments and therefore only relevant to federal governments, and I think that's that's an absolute misperception and myth. Both of the covenants make it explicitly clear, and the jurisprudence supports this, that the obligations under the covenants apply across all parts of a federal state, so across all levels and arms of government. And in a very recent decision by the UN Human Rights Committee, which involved alleged human rights violations by a Queensland police officer, the committee stated that the political units or constituent organs of a state, their acts are imputable to the federal state. So clearly these obligations of non-discrimination apply across all the levels and arms of government, and all levels and arms of government are in a position to and have a responsibility to engage those obligations.
Okay.
Just if I can very briefly touch on the other two rights that we identified as being relevant. They are the right to health. And we identify that as particularly relevant for two reasons. First, because discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or activity in the area of access to healthcare is an issue. And moreover, because we know that discrimination has adverse health impacts. It's well established that discrimination can result in social exclusion, can result in difficulties coping, stress, mental health problems, and so on. And clearly, it's incongruent with the obligation in relation to the right to health to establish the conditions necessary for good health. The other right that we briefly touch upon is the rights of children. Children who are cared for by members of same-sex couples will clearly experience the adverse impacts of discrimination against those carers, and that's a clear violation of provisions both under the ICCPR relating to the protection of children and measures for the protection of children, and similarly under the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which contains provisions again relating to the protection of children and the conditions necessary for children to, if you like, be socially included and participate. As I say, that's the broad framework for analysis that we've adopted, and I guess would argue that against which relevant federal, state and even local laws should be assessed and analysed. And I'm rather than go into it much more detail, it might be more fruitful to have a discussion.
Thank you. Would appreciate the chance to raise a couple of issues with you, some of which you've touched on, but I'm interested to hear a bit more about. You say in your submission that Article 2 of ICCPR and ICESCR affirms the right to freedom from discrimination, and you also note that that article in both covenants only applies to the rights listed in those covenants, yet Article 26 of the ICCPR has a broader application in terms to the right to equality before the law. Could you expand on the information you've provided about the difference in approach to discrimination between Articles 2 and 26? Which of these provides the most useful basis, do you say, for consideration of discrimination experienced by people in same-sex relationships?
I think both. They're certainly not mutually exclusive. Mm. The Article 2 protection, as you say, relates to protection from discrimination in the realisation of rights. So in those areas of life where the covenants recognise that people have particular rights, such as the right to freely associate, or in the case of the Civil and Political Rights Covenant, or the right to health, or the right to social security, or the right to adequate housing in the Economic, Social and Cultural Rights Covenant, then discrimination on one of the on the grounds of one of the protected attributes, if you like, would be or is unlawful. As you say, the prohibition under Article 26 is broader and relates to protection from discrimination, again on the enumerated grounds, which, as I said earlier, are non-exhaustive, but in any area of public life, public or private life, regulated by a public authority. I think that, I mean, if you that's probably the most robust provision, because it's not limited to the rights contained within the covenant, and because I think it probably more fully engages the obligations to respect, protect and fulfil under the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights.
Thanks for that. I wanted to talk with you about the two major Australian two major Human Rights Committee communications regarding same-sex relationships in Australia, Toonen and Young, because they seem to provide different analyses of discrimination on the basis of sexual preference. Toonen includes the reference to sex in Articles 2 and 26 to include sexual orientation, and Young seems to find that Australia violated Article 26 of the ICCPR by denying Mr. Young a pension on the basis of his sex or sexual orientation. There's some suggestion that Young was decided on the grounds that sexual orientation fell under the category of discrimination on the grounds of other status. Do you think it matters whether discrimination under the ICCPR is characterised as discrimination on the grounds of other status or discrimination on the grounds of sex?
We would argue that it falls under both attributes. In the event I don't think it matters, for the purpose of the international human rights jurisprudence, who it may matter for is the people who are subject to discrimination and who are, if you like, being classified as being discriminated against in a particular way. But jurisprudentially, I don't think it makes any difference.
Do you have any problems then extending the logic of the Human Rights Committee to apply to ICSCR and the CRC?
I'm not sure that I fully understand the question.
Well, extending the logic. Using ICCPR, do you have any problem with extending that logic to apply to the other conventions?
No, I don't. In fact, I'm sure that if there was an individual complaints mechanism under the other conventions, that's the way the jurisprudence would evolve. Particularly given the importance of reading and applying the conventions in a way which is mutually reinforcing and interdependent.
Okay, well, that's good. Turning now to the rights specific to children, you say that CROC prohibits discrimination which impacts upon children of same-sex partners. Are you aware of any instances where CROC provisions have been specifically interpreted to include prohibition of discrimination on the basis of parents being in a same-sex relationship?
I'm not off the top of my head, but it's certainly something that I can take on notice and get back to you on.
Well, that would be helpful because we haven't, found any.
Okay.
If there were any that you're aware of, or perhaps cases which explain how much of a connection there needs to be between discrimination against parents, the impact of children, so as to amount to a breach of Article 2.2
of the convention
of CROC.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'll take that on notice and get back to you. Hopefully by early next week.
Do you think that you can assume that it's automatically correct that where there is discrimination against parents of a child, there'll be a breach of Article 2.2?
I think that's probably a fair statement.
Mm.
Unless the exception to, if you like, unlawful discrimination can be established, namely that the discrimination against the parents is reasonable and based on objective criteria and otherwise consistent with the rights contained in the relevant convention.
Do you think then that discrimination against parents in the context of things like Medicare, Social Security, might breach some of the substantive provisions of the CRC independently of Article 2.2? You know, things like best interests of the child or right to privacy, right to the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health?
Potentially, insofar certainly, as they impact on the capacity of parents or carers to provide the conditions that are provided for under the CRC.
And do you think too that, and I mean, I'm just advancing these things to, if you like, test them a bit, what about some of the parenting provisions like Article 5 and Article 18, or the right to identity in Article 7 and 8?
I guess it would be difficult, I'd need to give this some more thought, but difficult to directly engage the provisions of the CRC because the discrimination is against the child's parents or carers rather than against the child particularly, although as you've identified it may impact on the capacity of the child to realise various of the rights contained under the CRC.
Yeah. Well, we'd be interested in any thoughts you might have on that in terms of compiling the, you know, the human rights law chapter of the report, because
sure.
These are questions that we're pondering at the moment. So, I mean, either formal or informal discussions would be
sure.
Good. Can I come to the area of employment? You say in your submission that Australia has additional obligations under ILO 111. Are you aware of any ILO comments or jurisprudence that comments on non-discrimination against same-sex couples?
The ILO jurisprudence is broadly consistent with the Human Rights Committee jurisprudence, and that's reflected in the fact that Article 1 of the ILO Convention that we referred to basically draws on the committee's general comments or general comment in relation to discrimination in terms of the identification of what constitutes discrimination and the forms of discrimination that may be prohibited. We haven't looked at or discussed the jurisprudence or case law in the submission in relation to the ILO Convention, but again, that's something that we could do. But I think as a matter of general principle or a general statement that there's a broad consistency between that convention and the ICCPR in particular and the jurisprudence of the Human Rights Committee.
Well, I don't want to burden you with too much work, but I mean, I guess I'm flagging these because they are issues that we're pondering in terms of preparing that chapter of the report. So if you do have thoughts, that would be good. I mean, in the same context, in health, we're wondering about the increasing threshold of the Medicare safety net and whether that amounts to a breach of one of the ICHESCA health rights and or even the, under the CRC, even though it's a matter of about $500 in expenses, independently in... independently of Article 2 in each of the conventions. So they're just things that we're pondering.
Sure. The on that final question, as you would know, there's no complaints mechanism under the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, so you don't get the jurisprudence.
Yeah,
but the committee's looked in a fair bit of detail in their General Comment 14 at the right to health and what it entails, and have talked about... and similarly, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health has done some normative work around the content of the right to health, and they've all talked about the importance of access, adequacy and availability. So I think that measures which increase thresholds, and which by consequence reduce availability, access, or adequacy, would prima facie be inconsistent with the covenant, with that covenant, particularly given the obligations under that covenant to take positive steps towards the full realisation of those rights. So retrogressive measures in relation to the right to health are clearly impermissible under that covenant.
Well, that's sort of where we're coming from, I suppose. So, but we'll have a look at General Comment 14. But it's helpful that, you're sort of suggesting to us that we're not necessarily on a on the wrong track.
No, no.
No, that's good. I'm coming now to your comments on domestic legislation. When you go through the various pieces of domestic legislation to determine whether there's a brief, you give some qualified findings in some cases. For example, the parental leave provisions, you say, appears to be a breach of Article 26 of ICCPR, or may also constitute a breach of Article 2 of the CRC, and is a potential breach of ILO 111. And you've also said similar things regarding workers' compensation, superannuation, Victorian property settlements. Is there any reason why you haven't been more certain in your views as to breaches in those cases than in some of the other comments in the submission?
There's not. No.
Okay.
I mean,
that's helpful. We just thought you might be flagging something that was that we ought to be thinking more about.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, what we would say in relation to all of them is we've identified, if you like, prima facie breaches. The onus would then be on the state or the federal government to establish that the less favourable treatment is reasonable, objective, and otherwise consistent with the fundamental human rights contained in the relevant covenant. And so we certainly haven't identified any areas where they have done that, nor would we expect that they would be capable of doing so.
That's good. Finally, in your recommendation, you recommend that legislation ought to be amended so that entitlements available to de facto people in de facto relationships are available to people in same-sex relationships. And then alternatively, you recommend that same-sex couples should be allowed to marry. Which option do you think would be the better option and more in line with international human rights law?
I think the former would be probably a preferable option for the simple reason that it's much more politically viable. It's simply not foreseeable that at a federal level we'll see the recognition of a right of same-sex couples to marry. Moreover, that's an area where international human rights is itself problematic, and I think some of the jurisprudence is problematic because the provision relating to the right to marry under the ICCPR is the only provision which is gender-specific. So it would be it would be difficult to reconcile the latter position or our latter recommendation with the international human rights jurisprudence, which is not to say that it's not something that we support.
No, I understand what you're saying. But
but in terms of a recommendation that the Commission might make, I think that both for the purposes of political expediency and what's consistent with the ICCPR, that the recognition of interdependency relationships, if you like, and the equal treatment of people in same-sex and heterosexual de facto relationships is desirable. Can I also just make one remark about state legislation?
Sure.
We haven't looked at state legislation in our submission, but as you would know, the Victorian government has recently enacted Victorian Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities, which enters into force on the 1st of January of next year, for the most part in relation to certain provisions, the 1st of January 2008. That charter contains a prohibition on against discrimination, and entrenches the right to equality before the law and protection from discrimination. The bases upon which it entrenches that right to equality are those grounds that are identified in the existing Equal Opportunity Act, which of course includes sexual orientation in Victoria.
Sure.
But I think it's probably worthwhile just noting the possible impact of that legislation on any legislation in Victoria that's inconsistent.
Mm.
That legislation or that charter contains an interpretive provision which requires that all legislation, so far as possible consistent with its statutory purpose,
yep.
be interpreted and applied consistently with the charter.
Mm-hmm.
So it would seem to me that in Victoria, where there's inconsistent legislation, there'd be a strong case to say that that legislation should be reinterpreted in a way which is consistent with the right of same-sex couples to be free from discrimination. That's precisely what's occurred under the UK Human Rights Act, where in a recent House of Lords decision, a provision relating to succession in tenancy, which was limited to husband and wife, was reinterpreted to apply to people living as if husband and wife. So it was reinterpreted to apply to same-sex couples.
Oh, that's interesting. Are you able to provide us either now or later with a reference to that decision?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because we spoke yesterday, I think, with the Law Institute of Victoria about the impact of the Victorian Human Rights Charter, and you know, clearly we're aware of the charter and its implications, but that's an interesting example of where you know, in another jurisdiction, the Human Rights Act had some impact. So.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I think it's certainly if we follow the path that the UK has adopted, it's probably fair to say that, or it's likely that Victorian legislation, which currently differentiates between heterosexual couples, de facto couples, and same-sex couples, will be reinterpreted to apply equally to both.
But of course, under the Victorian Charter, am I right? It couldn't be a court reinterpretation; it would have to come back to Parliament to be. Courts can't reinterpret legislation in that way under the Victorian Charter, can they?
No, they can. The interpretive provision is the, if you like, the primary remedial provision. It provides that legislation is to be interpreted so far as is possible consistent with a statutory purpose, so that it's consistent with the Charter.
I'm getting confused with the ACT.
The ACT contains a similar provision. Okay. What the courts have said in the ACT and the UK is that basically permits the reading in of provisions or the reading down of provisions to render the legislation, charter or Human Rights Act compliant, so long as to do so doesn't so strain the meaning of the legislation that you in effect destroy its purpose.
Okay.
So the Victorian Charter would have no impact on legislation which is explicitly and intentionally discriminatory, where the purpose is discrimination,
yep.
but where the discrimination is, if you like, inadvertent,
mm-hmm.
as was the case in the UK with the succession of tenancy,
yes.
you would be able to, I guess, they in that case read in the words as if husband and wife to render a Human Rights Act compliant meaning. What you're referring to is where it's simply not possible, consistent with the statutory purpose, to render a charter compliant meaning, that's when the court can issue a declaration saying that it's simply not possible to make this act or provision compatible with human rights, and that results in the remission of that act or subordinate legislation to Parliament for reconsideration.
And it's interesting to think about where the line might be drawn there. I mean, I'm trying to think of a relevant Victorian law because there aren't too many now where that might impact. But, you know, for some of the broadening of definitions, say, of spouse or something like that, would it be your view that that would be a matter that would need to be remitted to Parliament, or is that taking the court's capacity in that regard too far?
I think that there'd probably be an argument about it, but I think you could mount a very strong case that a reference to the term spouse in legislation under the Charter, and I should stress that the relevant provisions of the Charter in this respect don't come into force until 2008.
No, I understand that.
Lend themselves to an interpretation of the word spouse to include same-sex couples.
Right. Even if it was specifically defined in the legislation not to... If it was defined, as, let's say, as it is in the Federal Marriage Act.
It would depend on the wording of the legislation.
Mm.
I mean, that's precisely what happened in the UK,
yes,
where the words were husband and wife. Mm. If the legislation referred to spouse, and then the definition section referred to a spouse is a husband or wife, then I think that you could probably render a charter compatible meaning by saying people who are living as if husband and wife, which may include same-sex couples.
Yeah.
So long as the purpose of the legislation wasn't to discriminate on those grounds, which case you couldn't render that kind of interpretation, because it would destroy the statutory purpose.
Understand. All right, well, thank you. That's been helpful and fascinating. I've enjoyed that discussion, so thank you very much for that and for your Centre's submission. We'll look forward to
I'll send through the material.
Yeah, or even if you just contact us and we can have a talk about some of that. That'd be
sure.
Great.